Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. Last time out, we brought you part one of our fascinating conversation with Gary McGann. Today, we have part two. Please enjoy. Developing on from then the culture side of it, you know, the big difference between establishing a culture in its kind of an organic version when you're dealing with one company, right? And then, you know, use the Smurfit Kappa idea of, you know, Smurfit obviously had its culture, Kappa had its culture, and then you brought the two of them together. And it's not about one culture subsuming the other or vice versa. It's about the optimization of it. You know, how do you optimize a culture when you do a big deal like that? Because there wasn't a lot of difference in size between the two companies, really.
No. I mean, as you know, it was a merger, but it wasn't a merger of equals, but it was a merger of huge unequals.
Yeah.
All I can tell you is from my own experience. So we've done about three of those on my watch, Smurfit and Kappa. We did the Paddy Power Betfair one, and then we did the Flutter Stars Group, which brought a number of brands there. In all cases, because of deals requiring to be confidential up to a certain point, and more particularly because deals need to not take the eye off the ball of having to earn the crust today. Obviously, a lot of these were done in secret up to a certain point in time. And then, you know, you talk to a load of people who yesterday are trying to kill one another, and today you're telling them not only your friends, but you're actually relations and close relations. It takes time. I think you need to bring people together. I think you need to generally, the most important lesson I've certainly learned and tried to learn is everybody has something to bring to the party, because why the heck would you put the two together in the first instance if they hadn't? And it's not just what people call markets or factories or equipment or IP. It's people. Ultimately, it's all down to people. And so if you can't get people to work together and align behind the new opportunity, by and large, I was looking in the Smurfit Kappa. We had the financial crisis almost immediately. So a common enemy galvanizes people into not sweating the small stuff. But the second thing is, we were quite decisive early on in terms of, there were two of everything in every market. And I was very careful to ensure that we didn't just have a dominant area and race outcome if we could. So we pushed very hard to ensure we got some degree of balance, so there wasn't a perception that this is just a hoovering up job and a total wipeout type of thing. Because Kappa and Smurfit both had something really interesting to bring. In the case of Paddy Power, we had two different brands. We didn't merge them into one brand, but we needed them to behave in the same markets with one another. And then we had Skyback coming in off the Stars Group. And so we had three brands in one market, all of them previously absolutely head-to-head. So again, what they learnt was, what are they doing well? What are we doing well? Where are the demarcations? And getting people, as I say, to talk it out. We used to have and did have and do have today, you know, good open conversations that says, so we were bitter enemies yesterday and now we're together. What do we do? How do we live together? How do we do more than live together? How do we actually build off one another's
flourish together?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's not going from, you know, enemies to flourishing together. That's a journey.
Yeah. The other question I've asked CEOs is, how do you manage your board and your investors when things aren't going well?
Communication. I mean, there's an old principle in life. If you get the get out ahead of trouble, trouble happens, problems happen. I think two things that really cause failure is if you delay or hide in the hope it's going to get better, it never does. And second, if you delay and hide, people wonder whether you're on top of it at all. Did you realize you had the problem? Are you just kind of coming to grips with it at too late a stage? So, in principle, early warnings, not like nobody appreciates anybody arriving with a problem with no idea of a solution. But it doesn't necessarily need to be the perfect solution. But I think early communication, boards need to be mature enough to say, here's early communication, we have a problem. Haven't got the full analysis done. Don't know yet what we're going to do about it. I'm just telling you so that you won't hear it later. But then urgency, applying yourself to it pretty urgently is critically important. But the most, I think people most get caught out on is not being aware they have a problem in the first instance.
And, when you look at it from an investor's perspective, then is it about, having an ongoing dialogue with your big investors? And so that it's not, you're not just coming to them when there's bad news,
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we work, every company I've been in, I think I hope they would, and your colleagues in Davies would be a good barometer of this, but that we do work the street hard. We do treat, to go back to your earlier description, our stakeholders and more, our shareholders are important stakeholders. They're not just kind of twice a year, four times a year, good, bad, or indifferent. So, I mean, engaging with them, bringing them with them, they're good sounding boards, they're good ones. You just figure out the ones that are actually for the long haul, which is kind of more than 3 or 6 months.
Or 6 days in some cases.
Well, exactly, yeah. The flippers.
Yeah.
And some know the industry very well, as I think from others who are just great investors. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you can't, while it's time consuming, this is where people wonder how business people spend so much time doing. Communication is time consuming, but it's a massively rewarding initiative.
Mm-hmm. We talked about people earlier on, but where are you in terms of hiring talent or developing from within?
I think a bit of both. I'm a big fan of developing talent, particularly if we go back to the principle of, a kind of a sense of purpose. It's people aren't going around with kind of chips in their brain. You take the chip from the old company out and put the chip for the new company in. So people who are learning their trade with you and growing with you generally are really, really high value. However, if you do only that, you end up with kind of the echo chamber and kind of the lack of breadth of thinking and so on. So a good balance between the two, I think, is important. It's very challenging in very highly focused businesses to import people from outside the business and get them to lead a big part of the operation, not having been part of it. But you need to do it, and you need the organization not to, what I call organ rejection needs to be avoided. The more I watch businesses, and particularly so today, where, I certainly, and even probably in your generation to some extent, people spent good lengths of time with companies, and they were loyal to the company until there was an opportunity that they couldn't just pass over. Nowadays, it's guns for hire. There's a huge amount of guns for hire. And so if you're going to develop really quality people and you're the best at what you do, Clutter is the number one, Smurfit Kappa is the number one, you're a target. Mm. So if you don't develop a lot of your own people, but including not just skill sets, but the whole kind of how we do business, the culture part, but yet get some fresh blood in to shake it up. Otherwise, you get into this complacency and kind of herd mentality. I was the most senior person ever recruited into Smurfit. So I can tell you it was a shock for me, but I suspect it probably was a shock for them as well. I was lucky again, the timing. But we grew an awful lot. We had a fantastic apprentice program, still have. We also had a young manager trainee program. We also had swimming Australian style, as I used to describe it. When you're 6 months old, throw you into the deep end. If you sink, you sink. If you swim, you swim. So we gave fellas opportunities to run their own plants with silent and invisible people watching that they don't crash completely. So I think it's the mix that works best. I see it in Flutter as well.
I often think that when it comes to developing people, there is a certain element of you bring someone, you develop them through your organisation. There's a finite amount that they can learn from your organisation, and you have to be willing to let them go and learn other stuff and hope the boomerang works and that they potentially come back as a there's an opportunity for you to get them back even better than a more finished article than they left you with.
Yeah, 100%. I think any employer, any boss, whatever way we want to describe it, has a fundamental obligation, which is to allow people to achieve their full potential, whatever that is. So for some people, it'll be there, it'll be at a certain level. Other people, it'll be twice, three times. Mm. And if you can provide exposure and experience equivalent to what they get by leaving, then we should be happily letting them go. I've never worked in a business where the business lost out by letting really good people go to do something even better. What drove me crazy was watching people leave to do something similar or even less with a lesser company. That was a huge failure on my part and the company's part, in my view. And you're right. I see the boomerang. We see more of it, I think, because there's so much of this kind of relatively short tenure. People want to go off and do whatever they want to do, which is a great thing. But the more international the business and the larger the business, the more diverse the business. And while the Smurfit Kappa was kind of homogeneous product-wise, or fairly homogeneous, in Flutter, it's much more heterogeneous. And so we provide a much bigger and wider and more exciting world than most of our competitors. But it still doesn't mean that people wouldn't
won't
benefit.
Scratch every itch.
Yeah. You know? And I'd be very disappointed if it did, because then we haven't hired people who are even greater and more aspirational than we have. Speed of opportunity is the big issue.
Yeah. There's a great saying I've heard that says, change happens when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change. All right. And I think when you took over Aer Lingus, you had to take it through a huge amount of cost cutting and change. So what do you see as the right approach to change within businesses?
I think the one, it's a good example of it, Aidan. I think, whether the amount of people I've met, even in physical terms, who are in pain for a lot longer than they should before they do something about it. So there is an almost, the realization that there's pain and that you're in pain is critical. And the longer you take to acknowledge and accept it, the far greater and worse the medicine is going to be to actually correct it. And in Aer Lingus, there were utter denial. Mm-hmm. Aer Lingus was in multiple businesses, multiple industries, multiple companies. And the only company, or almost the only company, that was making no money for years was the airline piece of it, which was, you go back to your purpose, they were set up to be in the airline business. So one of the things we had to do was actually figure out, what business are we in? Can we make a go of it? Have we the right to succeed? And what do we need to do to get there? And of course, it was, classic semi-stage is difficult. It was overmanned. But I don't blame it. Blame is the wrong word, but never hold the frontline people accountable for those type of excesses. That's management. Mm. And what we really struggled with in Aer Lingus was a block in the middle. It was a bit like having drunk 9 pints of milk and it's stuck in your stomach, not can get up or down. And so the tone from the top didn't get down and the echo from the bottom certainly didn't get up. Mm. And so there's a logical kind of antidote to that, and to take the blockage away.
Switching again, I suppose, the thing I'm interested in, and it's pertinent given the recent time, is your approach to crisis management. So, we can talk about the specifics in general, but if you think back a couple of weeks ago, we had the whole situation with BBC and Gary Lineker, right? When you look at your career, what was your approach to crisis management as a chief executive, and then maybe laterally as a chairman? And are they different? Because they are very different roles, I suppose.
Yeah, and I mean, I have a very clear view in my mind. The CEO runs the company, the chair runs the board.
Yeah.
And the board don't actually run the company. They actually create the enablers and they hire the top talent to run it. And they dictate, hopefully not, but guide and engage on strategy and hold the organization to account, but they don't run the company. So I think in crisis, the critical issue is if you're starting to figure out what a crisis looks like and what being in a crisis feels like, and you're only beginning to develop the muscle for a crisis when it happens, you're dead in the water. Because the one thing about crisis is early first and early steps and getting out ahead of it. And in the airline business, I remember Michael Bishop when British Midlands had their famous crash. Michael Bishop was on Sky TV with a microphone in front of him 20 minutes after the crash, saying, awful situation, lots of people dead, but saying all the right things. TWA, I'm dating myself now, TWA had the famous crash. CEO didn't hit the airwaves for 3 days. Game was over. He was lost. He was gone within months, and TWA were gone within a couple of years. So I think it's you like most things in life, you need to practice. Nobody will figure out what the crisis will be, but understand how will we react in a crisis, and who will talk to whom and when, and what if they're missing. So it's all ticking all the boxes and doing the bit of trial runs. And as I say, you know, if you think about it in terms of sporting terms, the weather conditions will not be predictable. Mm. But if you don't have practiced in some weather conditions, then you've no chance.
I'm always reminded too of that famous press conference with Mike Ryan around COVID. He said, if you're waiting for perfect, you're waiting too long. You've got to act. And you're not going to be right. But what you've got to do is, what you're hoping is, the more actions you take, you get incrementally more right. And therefore, you get through the crisis that you're in.
And he's a very good example, I think, of the people that featured at that time. And like, history has proven him 100% right. I mean, everything that was acted on wasn't 100% right, but the statement and the encouragement was 100% right. But I think the second thing is, and it's wonderfully easy to talk about it, but calm under fire. Like, nobody follows a panicky, depressive, clueless leader. I mean, that's, you know, we all talk about wartime generals, and there's no doubt about it. Figuring out who your wartime generals might be is important as well. Who are the people who are going to? Because some people crack badly under strain of crisis. It's not a total failing. It's just horses for courses. But I worked with in Graham Mesh, owned Gilby's at the time. I remember many years ago when I was CFO, the Bailey's story was just going up and up and up. Countries, cases, everything flying. And then we hit the 92 kind of downturn. And every second Tuesday, Ned Sullivan would bring all his international marketing guys from Bailey's in. We'd have a review of how we're doing. And I used to produce it, literally paper graphs, a few graphs. And the forward pipeline was coming down. I remember handing them around just before the meeting because there was nothing to pre-read. And I saw the guys turn them upside down because they thought they were eating them the wrong way around. And I remember telling George Bull, who was the CEO of Grand Met and eventually CEO of Diageo, and he's a big barrel-chested army colonel, and he said, they've never been to war, Gary. They've never been to war. And there is an element of truth in that.
When you think back through your career, you know, who are the three or four people that you have sought advice from, or that you've learned the most from, maybe as an observer of them?
Yeah, I think in most situations in life, you probably learn the most, or you're more like a sponge in your formative years, and either through arrogance or stupidity, you get less and less spongy in your later years, and unfortunately, people actually expect you to be expunging rather than the opposite. So as I said, John Ronan and Vincent Daly, it wasn't just that they gave me an opportunity to break, but they actually encouraged me to go as far as I could. I went into Vincent Daly, I'd say, four times to resign, and three times I came out with a bigger job, and I didn't go in to get a bigger job and ready to kill for him. That's how inspirational he was. And the fourth time he said to me, you should go, because I wouldn't go to Sweden and so on, which was the Gilby's job, the CFO in Gilby's. And so they were definitely... Bernie Cahill in wartime. Bernie was absolutely... If you wanted somebody at your back when you were fighting a battle, Bernie didn't have any reverse gears. None. Absolutely... You know, some people call him like bull-like, etc. He was outstandingly courageous. I think in crisis, if you think about the financial crisis, think about even COVID, you know, people often wonder, what do we lose in these things? I think the great kind of downside of them quite often is courage. Mm-hmm. You know, people being courageous enough to pick themselves up, dust themselves down and move on. Bernie, He was in Green Corps, one of the famous problems. He was like, he was definitely, people used to describe him as a company doctor. He wasn't remotely a company doctor. He was just a great, courageous leader. David Dand was just one of these visionaries. I mean, you know, that Bailey's exists today and the manner in which it was conceptualized. It's like all great successes. There's many masters and the others are orphans, but most honest people would say David Dand was critical cornerstone to that, and indeed Ned Sullivan, who sold it worldwide.
I'm always remember one of the, from, and you know him from your past as well, one of the most impressive people I ever met to talk to as an executive was Jerry Robinson.
Well, he just had it just came so naturally.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a fireside. Everything was like a fireside chat.
Yeah, you felt like you were sitting there with your granddad every day.
But the other one then finally is because I think in my career, like, there were three really outstanding people before Dennis O'Brien came along and the guys today, and that was Michael Smurfit, Tony Ryan, and to be fair, Tony O'Reilly as well. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of knowing Tony Ryan, even though we were eventually big competitors. But Michael, like, these guys were different. Mm-hmm. They were like, you couldn't but learn from just listening to their views on the most stupid thing. You say, Jesus, like, how could you think about it like that? And the answer was, they thought about things differently.
Differently, yeah.
They didn't have a formula. Mm-hmm. They had just this brain that seemed to work that way.
And you mentioned that you know, as you went through your career, you were very lucky to have some instrumental individuals that gave you opportunity, that gave you, you know, enough rope to either hang yourself or to be very, very successful. Yeah. Have you, now that the shoe is reversed a bit, have you done the same?
I aspire to, and I hope so. I never worried. John Ronahan is the one who most gave me breaks. I mean, John gave me his job piecemeal over a few years. Mm. And he knew what was happening. And I was this kind of in a hurry young guy. I want to do more. And he knew I'd work longer hours, etc., to do it. But he'd let me, and he'd help me. Mm. And so I learned an awful lot about it. So I never feared in latter life, particularly once the kids were at an age where I wasn't going to be unemployed and unable to provide for them. That was kind of that fear factor is a kind of a great bedrock. But leaving that aside, I never feared working myself out of a job, working on the principle that if I did, something would come along, and particularly if I did the right thing by other people. But the real challenge, I think, always is to make sure you're identifying the talent. And some people are brilliant at it, and other people take a bit longer. I'm probably in the take a bit longer brigade, but I definitely think the principle of, when you look back, and I spend, unfortunately, more time looking back than looking forward, but I believe passionately that nobody remembers you for what you've done. They remember you for what you left behind, and that's people. I mean, leaving assets behind, or beautiful buildings or computer systems, all very interesting, but the real juice is in the quality of the people and the people dynamic. And you know, I think if you ask me, like, I think Tony Smurfit took over from me, and it just went from strength to strength. He's done a phenomenal job. And that's fantastic. Mm. I think in Flutter we've had I'm chair now nearly 9 years, and in my time we've had three CEOs, and it's just gone from strength to strength. And the current CEO's shooting the lights out. Mm. Sorry, the current team. Mm. I mean, there's a bunch of them.
Switching then in terms of that role, that the difference between the chairman and the chief executive role. Now, you said it was very clear the chairman is a non-executive role and the CEO is an executive role, but you've sat on in both camps. So, you know, did the fact that you were a CEO make you a better chairman?
I think, as I said to you earlier, it probably made me go and make a lot of apologies to chairman that I worked with. I think it depends. I think there's pluses and minuses. I think the big challenge, I literally went from being CEO straight in. I'd been chair of Dublin Airport while I was CEO. That actually was quite helpful in a way, because as one guy who worked with me, we brought him in, he was very good, and he would say to me, thank God you're busy, because if you weren't, you'd be over helpful. And that So you have to learn to kind of withdraw and draw the line between the two. And while you intellectually know it, it's the instinctive stuff. But the analogy I use is in football terms. So being the CEO is a bit like in soccer terms, like being the midfield general, the John Giles kind of dictates the pace, passes the ball around, slows it down, speeds it up. If you become a non-executive director, it's like being sent to the stands. And if you make it to chairman, you're allowed back on the sideline. But if you encroach on the pitch, you get a red card. So that, for me, is kind of the way the analogy that works for me. I think it's helpful. Certainly, I think it's generally helpful for CEOs to have a chair who's got to grips with the difference, but has been a CEO, because they're much more empathy and understanding minded of what they're about and what they're trying to toil with, what's difficult. But also, there's a more natural instinct for CEOs to talk to former CEOs as their chair, rather than people who have come from outer the Hebrides or Mars or something.
There's a lot of debate, you know, I see it in public markets about, you know, there's a natural positioning within the US that you get an awful lot of chairman and CEO being the same person. In Europe, it's much more about splitting the two roles. Where are you on that debate?
I'm a big believer. While I would have railed against the growth in governance over the years, and part of that was probably the natural instinct to push back and resist. As I look at them in terms of tenure, in terms of the split between chair and CEO, I think there's more sense than nonsense in it. And I think it's very, to take it to its extreme, your example of CBS and Sumner Redstone, like the chair and CEO can pack the board, it's a challenge always for a chair to make sure that people challenge a top-class CEO rather than being overawed by them. And for a CEO to accept the challenge from people who don't know as much about the business as they do, but have worldly wisdom. I describe the best boards for me are like the cheapest consultants you can ever get, because they're paid board fees, which are not nothing, but they're nothing like the McKinsey's and Bain's and BCG's. And if you've got the right ones, the right experience. And so I think a chair that actually holds that balance between the exec and non-exec and forces the exec not to accept that they absolutely are experts in everything and know the right answer to everything. I just think now, if you've got an entrepreneurial leader, sometimes they can actually manage as well, but quite often not. But if you can, sometimes it will.
Moving tack a little bit, what do you do in your downtime? You did mention you have some grandchildren that keep you very busy.
Well, I was very lucky in the sense that when the financial crisis happened, my first granddaughter was born, and I kept my sanity because of her. And in the middle of COVID, my youngest daughter had a baby, a donor baby. And not only did she keep my sanity, but I don't have to pay for entertainment anymore. I get it on the drip. So I give as much time as I can to her. So any interest in getting back to hitting a golf ball, any decent distance, or other than that, I don't. So we're a very close family. So we went away for a week at Christmas, and a friend of mine was asking me what we were doing. I said, we're like the Von Trapp family. We're on maneuvers. So the family are big for me, because I spent a lot of time away from the family. So I'm getting a second chance, and that's not to be wasted. And, you know, even my best days in golf don't feel as good as this. And I try to keep fit, and as you can observe, I'm not winning that battle as much as I used to. But that's about it. It's boring.
What advice would you give your younger self today, and then young people in general today? And are they different?
It's a good question. I think my young self, I would have learnt earlier what great leadership is about. I tell the story to my kids in particular when I was really ambitious to a point of excess. Again, it was in my Ericsson days. And I was basically told at the annual review one year, I had done a fantastic job and earned a full bonus, but I was getting half because I'd left a trail of destruction behind me in people terms. And I was harsh. And I realise now, realised very much sooner than now, that, you know, if you want to be a solo performer, you need to become a technologist or some sort of guru or something. But if you actually want to be in business and enjoy the great pleasure of working with people that are smart and engaging, you need to be able to engage with them and give and take and listen and not, you know, the punishing environment is never good and certainly shouldn't last at all. I mean, I think you just need to root it out. And I would have been rooted out if that was the case in the early years. Again, I was lucky to find people who were tolerant of me because they believed I could change. Now, they helped me, but I think, as I said to you, I said to somebody earlier today, they were cyclists, and I said, no, I'm not a cyclist because my backside wasn't built for a saddle. And they said, oh, you could harden it up. And I said, no, I got enough kicks in the backside to harden it up. It's just I'm not a cyclist. And I think that would be the main one, I'd say. For younger people, I think the great positive of the world, and by that I mean Irish world we live in today, is there are no real boundaries. Like, the world is literally our oyster. If somebody said that to me, I'd say, yeah. Mm. But, I mean, when I went to Stockholm, I remember thinking I'd gone to Mars. I had never really been out of the country, certainly not on business, and kind of meeting big bosses and being overawed. Like, I would encourage young people to, and we've great young people, for example, in Flutter, to listen, to have the kind of the ability to listen for at least enough time to figure out with the filter whether it's a waste of time or whether it's worthwhile, as distinct from figuring out that they know it all themselves, because they are very smart at what they do, but they're not fully rounded. So, you know, everybody learns all the time. So being open to learning, which I think travel gives people. I think the international world that we have here in our doorsteps from all the international companies is phenomenal when I think about it, really, and the derived benefit of it. And believe in themselves. I mean, why should anybody limit their ambition? I hear a lot about work-life balance, and it's hugely sensible. But I still see the great successes are still not getting it quite right. Mm. Now, it's better than it was. But they need to figure out what they want in life and be satisfied with it.
I know you have a huge interest in education, and particularly education within the young people. Do you want to give me a bit of insight where that is and what it means to you?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think our only natural resource in this country are people. Mm-hmm. I think all of the successes during my business lifetime that Ireland Inc. has enjoyed have been as a result of our education system. I think Dun O'Malley's initiative in 1966 is a pivotal point in terms of how we thought about it. And I think it is critical now that we understand education more widely than my mother did, which was, you know, professions, white collar. If I told her I was going to the vocational school or to the tech or whatever it was called in those days, or I was going to be apprenticed to a plumber, which I might have been much better off. Mind you, the plumbing wouldn't have been great. But nowadays, I think we're much more open to actually people finding their niche and through the educational options, finding their niche. Because everybody has a right to achieve their full potential. What bothers me is, given that people are our only resource, education was our route to success, we are losing ground all the time in the universities. The technical colleges are getting better and better. I mean, the new technical universities are a good move in the right direction. But we need much broader than that. So apprenticeship programs. In CISC, we've really got a top-class apprentice program for the crafts. And indeed, the young managers program. I think every decent company now has, you know, graduate trainees, even young managers, people who have done one thing and want to do something else. And they kind of, the profession for life and job for life is really passe. I mean, people, as I've explained to you, if my beginning was something to go by, like the concept of actually figuring out what you want to do, probably at 15 now when you have to make choices on subjects, at 18 when you have to decide whether you go to tech or university or go to work, like, That can't be the defining moment for the rest of your life. And so our educational system and our transition programs and so on are critical. But I think we need to be careful that we're not just churning out university, classic university graduates, where they're 10 a penny and all of a sudden a bachelor's degree is not worth the papers written on. You have to have a master's, and then, you know, you're dumbing down almost the whole thing instead of spreading it out a bit more.
Couldn't agree more, I think. And then I do think education is not just about the formal education. I always say to people that are working with me, you know, you can't let a week go by where you can't look back and go, I learned something this week. If you're not learning something every week or every month, something new, whatever job you're in, it's time to move on from that job.
It's a great point. And in fact, I missed that point. The one other thing I'd say to people, there's no stupid questions. Mm. There are a lot of stupid answers. Mm-hmm. But so ask. Most people are gracious enough to be happy to respond to people who are inquiring. Being inquisitive is a great feature. And by and large, the more natural young, the Irish abroad are massively inquisitive. Mm-hmm. The Irish at home are generally so as well, but it's a good feature of our, like, we're decent people. Mm-hmm. We generally get on with most societies. So why not?
Yeah. We have a closing tradition, or I'm starting a closing tradition on this podcast, where I ask, the last question comes not from me, but from one of our previous guests. I don't know what the question is. I've literally just opened the book, as you can see in front of me. I can't tell you who asked the question, and they didn't know who the question was going to be put to, right? Well, your question is here, right? Your question goes as follows. There are six people, we're going out to dinner, six people, there's you, me, and four others. Who are the four and why?
that's a very, very good question. I'll give you the thoughtless one, the one that's instinctive, which is my family, because that is my great pleasure in life. But in terms of interesting people, I would be fascinated to sit down with Putin and understand what makes this guy tick, apart from money, etc. The most to be that evil, at least perception-wise, has to be really, really questionable. If you then go to the other extreme, while I was rare the Catholic, and I'm kind of, the closer I get to the gates, the more I practice, because just in case I get a bad call. But the Dalai Lama has always fascinated me as somebody who, I don't even know politically how he survives, and clearly he has something amazing, and he falls foul of it every once in a while. And that's two. I would love to sit down with Tiger Woods. I just think he's probably one of the greatest sportsmen I have ever seen in my lifetime. I like music, and I'm particularly interested in music. And I would have been a great Caruso fan. I was a great Mario Lanza fan. I'm really dating myself now. And Pavarotti, but Bocelli is. I went to the Met in New York for my birthday. My wife decided to bring me to the Met in New York to see Bocelli, and I can tell you, I wouldn't go to New York to the Met to see many people. So they'd be my four.
That's great. That's about it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank Gary McGann for joining us today. It's been really, really fascinating and a great, and we could probably chat for another hour or two, but I know you're a busy man. But listen, to everybody out there, don't forget to like, share and subscribe, and comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.